Okay, so now we continue. The Swarup of the Lord. Now here, Prabhupada is at the next paragraph, beginning with the chief engineer. The chief engineer. Now he's going to have a big discussion here about the relationship between well, what's usually called the God and the world. In the West, Western theology, but in a more sophisticated way is the relationship between Krishna and his energies. The chief engineer of a complicated construction does not personally take part in the construction. He doesn't have a hammers and nails, or he's not even a foreman. The chief engineer has the blueprints and kind of oversees, but he doesn't get directly involved. But he knows every nook and corner because everything is done under his direction. He knows everything about the construction, both directly and indirectly. So here's this term. You see, that's in the beginning. Anvayat itarataha ja arteshu abhigyat. And we said anvaya means in general terms it means connection, or as Prabhupada says, direct, connected, really associated, so directly. And then itaraha means, and the opposite, literally itara means just the contrary, which means indirect or not related, distinct and separate. So you can take this with regard to all affairs, charteshu, in all matters. Abhigyana. Here in the translation, Prabhupada kind of has this directly and indirectly modifying his abhigya, his awareness, his perception. But it also can be taken separately. He's related directly and indirectly to everything, and he's also abhigya. And so Prabhupada here, and you'll see how he mixes these two together. He knows everything about the construction, both directly and indirectly. How does he know directly? The chief engineer. Well, one way he knows directly is, a couple of things. First of all, if he knows the plans very well, he looks at his plans and he sees his plans, and it's in his head already as a kind of direct knowledge of the construction. He also may go and inspect and see it, that is identical with the plans. And indirectly would seem that the different people report to him, this is done, that is done, this is complete. That's all I can think of in terms of the example. Similarly, the personality of Godhead, who is the supreme engineer of the cosmic manifestation, knows every nook and corner. So actually, because he's omniscient, he also he's always there inspecting at all times. Although affairs are being carried out by the demigods, those are his agents. So he does it, but he does it through the agency of the demigods. I've mentioned this a number of times. I asked Prabhupada this question here, that if Krishna is omnipotent, why does he need all these demigods to create a universe, to run the universe? And he said to me, you don't know how to run a universe. Which is true. I could not argue with that. Well, anyway, he has his reasons. Beginning from Brahma down to the insignificant ant, no one is independent in the material creation. So here's this continual dependence. The hand of the Lord is seen everywhere. So again, his directness. All material elements as well as spiritual parts emanate from him only. And whatever is created in this material world is but the interaction of two energies, the material and the spiritual, which emanate from the Absolute Truth, Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. This is the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, I'm going to tell you everything there is to be known, and beyond that there's nothing further to be known. And then he says, there's my material energy, earth, water, fire, my eightfold, ashtada. You know these passages. And then besides that, there's this other energy, which are the spiritual sparks, the spiritual energies, apara and para prakriti. Shakti or prakriti is another word, prakriti. There are these two in this world. And then he says everything arises from the confluence, the combination, coming together of these two energies. Both of these come from me, and beyond me there's nothing further to be known. That's it. That's what there is, right? Matter, spirit, and the origin of both. So he's saying the same thing here. These are the two energies in these world that come together, and they come from Krishna. So in this way he is connected. He's connected. Anvaya. He's connected. A chemist can manufacture water in a chemical laboratory by mixing hydrogen and oxygen. But in reality, so here's a chemist who's creating something. I'm making water. Right? I think this is an example. Just like Brahma may do something. But in really, the living entity works in the laboratory under the direction of the Supreme Lord. The chemist is able to do this because he's got a brain provided by the Supreme Lord. And actually, even he can only work his brain and work his body by the allowance of the Lord. So the chemist is actually an agent, so to speak, an expression of what the Lord is doing. And as he says here, the materials with which he works are supplied by the Lord. So in one sense you could say that only the Lord is working, but in this indirect way, through these different agents and energies. The Lord knows everything, directly and indirectly. Prabhupada repeats this. And he's cognizant of all minute details. And he's fully independent. He's compared to a mine of gold. And the cosmic creations in so many different forms are compared to objects made from gold, such as gold rings, necklaces, and so on. The gold rings and the gold necklaces are qualitatively one with the gold in the mine, but quantitatively the gold in the mine is different. Therefore, this is a standard example of oneness and difference. Therefore, the Absolute Truth is simultaneously one and different. Nothing is absolutely equal with the Absolute Truth, but at the same time, nothing is independent of the Absolute Truth. So here Prabhupada wants to bring you this doctrine of simultaneous oneness and difference. This is difficult to explain. And of course the full doctrine is achintya, means inconceivable. Veda, Veda, Tattva. So sometimes Prabhupada explains this in this way as qualitatively one and quantitatively distinct. Krishna is great, big, the living entities are tiny, but we're all Brahman, so we're qualitatively one, quantitatively distinct. One thing I have to say about this is not achincha. If something is identical in one aspect and different in another aspect, that's quite conceivable. So we have to look a little deeper into this. So here Prabhupada is getting into it in a way that we can sort of understand at least oneness and difference. But it really is a chincha. It is inconceivable. Because when you consider the and Jiva Goswami says this applies actually not just to the Lord and but to anything that has energies, the sun and the sunlight, we have to distinguish. The sun is in the room doesn't mean the sun globe is in the room, right? We have to distinguish on the one side. On the other side, who can say where the sun ends and the sunshine begins? You can look at it a certain way that it's just one entity or one process. You can't distinguish thing and its energies. So it's inconceivable, simultaneous oneness and difference. There are many different ways, doctrines that people have tried to express this, but this is Mahaprabhu's understanding. And I want to read you the way you can understand this. This is the very last purport in the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada said, although superficially, the Supreme Personality's word superficial, although superficially the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the living entity, material nature, and time appear to be different, nothing is different from the Supreme. But the Supreme is always different from everything. Lord Chaitanya's philosophy is that of inconceivable oneness and difference. This system of philosophy constitutes perfect knowledge of the absolute truth. So I have boiled this down a little bit. Nothing is different from Krishna, yet Krishna is different from everything. How do I understand this? Just keep saying it over and over again. like the Buddhist monks have their koan, which is usually a self-contradictory, mind-blowing. This is a koan. Nothing is different from Krishna, yet Krishna is different from everything. And saying it and see that way, right? So when you look out the window and you see a tree, you think that tree is different from Krishna, yet it is not. That tree is Krishna, yet it's not Krishna. Well, how is it Krishna? Well, because it's Krishna's energy, and you cannot really, the complete whole absolute truth, Krishna includes his energies. Krishna doesn't exclude, but at the same time, you have to distinguish between Krishna and his energies also. And of different kinds. Because the tree is not God. That tree is not the source of all creation. Nevertheless, it's related to that and it has its part in the complete whole. It's a way of seeing. This is really an important point here. Nothing is different from Krishna, yet Krishna is different from everything. In another place in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada says this, or very close to this, there is nothing but Sri Krishna. If you stop there, you'd be a Mayavadi. Nothing is different from Krishna. So there's nothing but Sri Krishna. Yet nothing is Sri Krishna save and except his own primordial personality. So you have to understand the relationship between Krishna and Krishna's energies. And it's not conceivable by a material mind. It can be conceived when the mind is in a transcendental position. So Krishna includes the world and at the same time transcends it. Exactly how that is, Bhagavatam will understand all these things. But you'll notice in the Bhagavatam how many descriptions there are, for example, of the universal form, this kind of pantheistic aspect of Krishna. Pantheism, you know, the idea that everything is divine or everything is God, is not entirely wrong. If you take it as the full answer, then it's incorrect. But there's truth to it. In theology, there's always this tension. They like to say, call it a tension. It's actually a contradiction, of course. Between the idea of God as transcendent, beyond this world, or beyond the material energy, and immanent, that he's within it. But the Vedic philosophy has it both ways. He is within everything, yet again, he is outside of everything. He is very near. This is the Ishopanishad. And he is far away as well. They have it both ways. If you can't understand it, that's not the problem with reality. That's the problem of our own inadequacies. Well, we can't understand anything. If you get into it far enough, you'll find out. So this is the resolution of the transcendence and eminence are both true. And people make a mistake. In the religious traditions coming from the Middle East, that warring family of Christians, Jews, and Muslims were always pounding on each other throughout history. You may notice, by the way, that although coming out of India, we have Hinduism, Buddhists, and Jains. We do not seem to see a lot of warfare. At least it seems to be a whole lot less. I mean, they argue with each other like crazy. They debate and everything like that. But basically, you don't see them burning each other at the stake. And it's true that suicide bombing was invented by Hindus. But they were Marxist Tamil tigers. They blew up the Prime Minister of India. So anyway, it's there in those religions from the Near East that tend to separate God and God's energies. They want to say there's a relationship, but they really keep a gap by denying. Again, now that, yeah, everything comes from nothing, but somehow or other God makes it happen. When they try to describe how God makes it happen in any detail, it starts to sound like emanation. At least all the accounts I've read of it trying to explain it. He says a word, and actually that word has this potency and it makes things appear out of nothing. Well, come on. The word was there, right? Speak something. But anyway, they want to separate in this way. And that makes it, that philosophy, I say that idea, if it's understood... if it's accepted it can tend to make an impediment to devotional service. Because the idea that everything is Krishna's energy really makes it understandable how everything can be used in Krishna's service. And you see all these places where Prabhupada talks about sacrifice and devotional service as the re-spiritualization of matter, which is by saying really you're removing the illusion and seeing everything in relationship to the Absolute Truth, where everything is ultimately spirit. It's only the illusion that disappears. And that, what is that illusion of separation? But if you got a theology that things are separated, not everybody understands the theology that way. They see a connection. But on the other hand, others do. But they're afraid if they say everything emanates from God, you'll become a pantheist or something. Or Thomas Aquinas, the Summa Contra Gentilis, denies emanation because it would mean God changes. We have answers for that one. So this is, you can separate. And in a way, I have to say that although Mayavad philosophy, it really wants to say how everything is one, you could say it's the ultimate in dualism. Because in Shankara's philosophy, what is the relationship between Brahman, the real Brahman, and the Brahman as it's seen through knowledge? What's the relation in his terms? What's the relationship between the impersonal Brahman and the world? There isn't any. You just can't get there from here. That, to me, is the ultimate in dualism. You just can't get there from here. But there is the statement is there in the Upanishads. I don't know that diacritics. Ekam eva. Means this is the definition of the Absolute Truth. It is that one in which there is no second thing. That besides which there is no other. There's no second thing. And Bhagavatam says, Bhayam eva adutiya. Fear arises in perceiving that there is some second thing other than Krishna, something that's not Krishna. So one without a second. Let me just talk to you a little bit about this word, absolute. And the contrasting term, relative. Now, the material world is the relative world because there are many things and they're related to each other and dependent upon each other and affecting each other. That's what's the world of change and mutability. The absolute means not relative, no relationships. That's what leads people like Shankaracharya to say, well, if there's the Absolute Truth and a world, then there's a relationship. Then the Absolute is relative, so there has to be just one and no second thing. Huh? It's just the logic of these ideas. And it shows up in the West. What's his name? Parmenides? I mean, pre-Socratic, that's really... this distinction between the absolute and the relative, right? They're one and there is no second thing. Well, what do we do about this? Well, here we have Krishna and the world. And in fact, Krishna has relatives. Right? In fact, he turns out to be supremely related. He's named after the son of Vasudeva, Nandu Tanuja. He's the, you know, he has relatives, and he's related to everybody. The idea of being a person really means that you're social and you're related and so on. That's why my body don't like this stuff. Is there fried with relationships? The idea of a good time is no relationship. No, so what do we do about this philosophical issue? Well, we have it both ways, because if you consider that the absolute truth that Krishna includes his energies, then there's nothing but Krishna. That's the first part. There's nothing but Krishna. He includes his energies. So if you say the absolute whole is Krishna and Krishna's energies, there's no second thing. When you think there's a second thing, and then when you think there's something that's not Krishna or not related to Krishna, that's called being in Maya. But yet Krishna is different from everything. He remains at the same time. But his relationships then are all, so to speak, within himself. Okay. And this is called that in the absolute truth there are Ishesha. Remember, Mayavadi philosophy is called Nirvishesha. As in Prabhupada's pranam mantra, Nirvishesha Srimivari Paschatshavesha. The Western world is full of Nirvishesha. This is one kind of impersonalism. That there are, the absolute truth has no Vishesha. Prabhupada usually calls this varieties. And what it means is particulars or individuals, something that's this and not that. So the idea of the impersonal aspect, Bhaktisiddhanta refers to as lax, L-A-X, not meaning the airport. You know what this meaning? Lax means an indolent perception. It means lazy. Oh yeah, there's one, there's no second thing that says, you know. But it's not. It's not. I mean, look, when I was 16, I speculated my way to the impersonal philosophy. It's not like such a great achievement. Everybody does it. And then you think you're smarter than all these people going to church and everything. They can't figure it out. Lax means lazy. Careless. They don't think. Because in many ways we have this idea of the impersonal absolute. You have the idea of nothing. You're talking about the greatest of all. But you're talking about something that has no name, no form, no qualities, no relationships. It's a zero. The actual idea conveyed by Chinchavedavita Tattva is extremely sophisticated. And it includes the absolute as an attribute. And you see, it doesn't make a mistake. So let's say I want to arrive at the notion of the absolute. And so what is the absolute? Well, I define it as non-relative. In fact, I systematically differentiate the absolute from the relative by the process of neti neti, not this, not that, it's not this, it's not that, it's not many, it's one, it's not dependent, it's independent. So here I think now I figured it out. But it turns out that my conception of the Absolute is of that which is just the opposite of the relative. Therefore, my conception is relative. I'm still in the world of duality. Or you can take, you know, the old philosophical idea of the one and the many. The one is the absolute and the many is the relative. Right? And so people try to come to the idea of the one. You have a capital O. It's so smart. As distinct with free from the idea of the many. But when you do that, you know, this one has excluded the many, and it's still, again, there's two things, at least the one and the many. So somehow the real one, the true one, has somehow got to both include the many. And similarly, the real absolute has to somehow include the relative, but in some transcendent or supernormal way. And that there has to be the many, but the many have to be so united and related to each other that they actually form a complete whole of one. So this is idea of the Bhakti, yeah.
Isn't that just go infinitely though in that direction, just in the sense that then you have the real one and the not real one, and then you have to have the real one and the real one and the not real one?
No, why not? Because
when you circle the one and the many with the real one,
yeah,
then you have the real one and the not real one.
the not real one is the one that excludes the many, right? Okay, but does when you have the real one, the not real one is just an aspect of the real one. Just like in the verse we're studying today, the illusion is one of the aspects of reality. Isn't it? It's in there, right? So we make allowance for the people who don't understand, and we include it in our thing. Whereas in Shankaracharya's philosophy, everyone is already enlightened.
What is Shankaracharya's problem with that argument?
What problem?
Huh? Well, does he respond to that argument? Because it seems pretty compelling to me.
I don't know if he responds to that argument. So some ways the best, some arguments, the best way to do them is pretend you never heard them. I don't know if that's what he does, because, you know, at a certain point I stopped reading Shankaracharya, but I don't know.
I think some people who can't accept that argument, the problem is with the inconceivability of the sameness and difference. They can't reconcile immanence and transcendence.
Yeah, sure, of course. And in a way, a mind that is still under the control of the illusory energy cannot do that. But we have a process by which, as we approach closer to Krishna, these things which are inconceivable become perceivable. It's just that usually when something is literally inconceivable means you can never possibly experience it. Maybe because it's logically contradictory or something like that. Huh? But here the inconceivable is conceived. And we ourselves become somewhat inconceivable in the brush. But here we are. There Krishna is. And it's just like somebody like Prabhupada, who seemed to unite so many contradictory qualities that you just couldn't even understand how he could possibly be that way. Be so powerful and so humble at the same time. Things that other, you know, people have said this thing about God. Nicholas of Cusa, I think a late medieval theologian, described the absolute truth. He was talking about God, but he was really, you know, coming to the absolute truth as the coincidence of opposites. And even I've discovered that really successful with spiritual life is to be able to do contradictory things. The Vedanta always does it. Every time people try to find a quote from Prabhupada, you can always find where he said the opposite. So many times.
That can't be enough, because any man being on the street would be spiritual.
Yeah, no, that's not the only thing, sure. Because it's coherent. But when the madman on the street says opposite things, or he's incoherent. But here you can sort of have opposite things and they're united somehow or other. They're coherent. Coincidence of opposites, not just the opposites thing.
So Simone Bell wrote that one of her ways of finding the truth was once she had arrived at a solid hypothesis, she tried to find all the ways in which the opposite was also true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a dialectical method, right? Anything else? Yeah?
This big paragraph that we just went through, a lot of it was Srila Prabhupada trying to explain what it means to either be connected with something directly and indirectly, or to know something directly and indirectly. And I have two questions from that. One is, I was just trying to understand, what's the value of saying that Krishna knows it indirectly? And the only thing that came to mind was how Krishna says in the ninth chapter of the Gita, everything rests on me, but it doesn't rest on me.
Yeah, exactly.
And so by saying that he knows it indirectly, or that he's connected with it indirectly, is the idea that he's not burdened by it, really. Right? Or he's not in some way, he's not like some guy that has to run around and do everything.
Yeah, he's aloof. You know, his energies work. His energies work, yet somehow or other he can be fully present in his energies. Mm-hmm. He can just be simultaneously present and absent.
He doesn't have to leave Radharani.
Yeah. I mean, that's just dig it. That's what you say. And you just say, wow, that's Krishna. Isn't he wonderful? Amazing what he does. But we should remember when we're talking about Krishna, we're talking about what is the reality. Krishna's not out there right now. Krishna's filling this room. We are within in Krishna. We are starting to get a glimpse of what's really happening. When we see the relationship with Krishna in this way. These statements are a guide ultimately to our perception. Not just a theory, but realized knowledge.
I had another idea about Krishna's direct and indirect knowledge of everything going on. It seems like it's a dream we all have to have absolute confidence and absolute enjoyment simultaneously. So you can get the job done perfectly and be on vacation.
That's right. That's very good. That's true also, an aspect of it. Right.
In that sense, then, is another, I've heard this, but I've never read it, another way to understand the Achintya Veda Veda Tattva is that it rests on the Lord's Achintya Shakti. Just as, actually, you said that before with Om Purnam, right? He just has such energy that he just takes. Yeah, he can actually be on vacation while taking care of
it. Yeah, that's right.
And that's a chintya to us.
Yeah, it is.
Unlimited energy.
Right, that's mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, we'll continue tomorrow. Thank you very much. Prabhupada, keep that.